I'm Brian Earle, and this is the Yes You Can segment in Zesty Garden. With me in studio is Adri Roberts, Cache County's Extension Family and Consumer Sciences Agent. And today we're going to talk about pressure canners and how nifty they are and how useful they are. But there are some things you need to know about them so that when you're canning your fruits and vegetables that they're taken care of. So mostly what I've seen canned in our canner are vegetables. Are there any fruits that you would put in a pressure canner?
You can, but you don't necessarily have to. I can, you know, the extension office, your local extension office, can give you the times for actually pressure canning fruits, but most people don't worry about it. But you definitely need to do meats and any vegetable because those have botulism spores on them. And in order to kill the botulism spores, you need that higher temperature of a pressure canner. Otherwise, you could run into problems. So
we're not talking about your pressure canner that's like a half gallon or a quart or whatever. This is a good size. I mean, it's like an oversized pressure cooker. But this is a pressure canner because you can put, 14 bottles in it? You
right.
can stack
right.
them in layers.
Right. Yeah. This is a big operation, basically. This is one to take really seriously because it could be dangerous if you don't really follow the directions closely. And so most of the foods that you do in there, the meats and things like that, need to be handled very, very carefully. And so that's why you use that, and you need to be familiar with how to run the pressure canner.
Now, we like to use at our home one of those, well, the brand name, but we've been using Camp Chef, but you can use any kind of a stove that you can set up outside because it keeps the heat from being in the house, and put the pressure canner on there. Plus, we have a smooth top stove, and those aren't recommended to do canners on. And it works really nifty having it outside. So this idea of canning meat, we've not canned meat before, but you can can meat, it sounds like.
You can. And
any types
wonderful.
Of meat?
Any type. Yeah, I had an elk call. The elk didn't call, but a lady called who was canning elk. You can use just about anything. We have done, in our little kitchen in the extension office, we've done chicken. And all you do is cube raw chicken, put it in a jar with no liquid. If you want to add some salt, you can. And then process it for the 90 minutes or so. And it's wonderful. It makes its own juices. You can, you know, use it and make some gravy and put it over mashed potatoes. It's wonderful for even, say, emergency preparedness when you can't cook a lot. To have these jars of meat ready. The beef is fabulous. It's great for enchiladas and, you know,
so
another
you're usually
gravy
cutting
or whatever.
Things into cubes?
Yes.
That's how it is? Okay.
Right.
So you can't just like take a steak and plop it in there.
The heat won't penetrate through the whole
yeah.
thing. And so it's best to cut it into the cubes and then just put it in the jar raw. No liquid. It's unbelievable.
Wow.
It
that sounds pretty
really
easy.
Well. Really easy.
So with the pressure canner, I know the one thing that we have to always make sure is how good is our gauge on the top? And some of them, they have the gauge. Others have just a pet cock that sits there. What do you need to do to make sure that what you have is adequate and that it's not gotten too old and will actually see the recipe through?
Okay, well, if you have a weighted gauge, it is round and heavier, and it has holes in it, and it has a 5, 10, and 15 on it. Probably in Utah, most of us will want to make sure we use that 15 slot gauge. Those don't have to be tested. If you have a dial gauge pressure canner, you need to bring them to your extension office to be tested. And so we can kind of, you know, most gauges are probably 1 or 2 pounds off at the most if they're not just right on. And we can show you what, for your elevation, you would process food. So this is a very important step that you do every year. If those gauges get bumped, you know, they can be thrown off. So that's the important thing to do is to call your extension office. Here in Cache County, we have equipment that we can test gauges from 8 to 5, 5 days a week. We do it free on Monday or $3 any other day. But other counties will vary. So you will want to call your local extension office. Sometimes they have special days they do it. So just check with them. But that's a really important step if you have a dial gauge that is tested every year. And probably every year I have about a dozen gauges that are malfunctioning. And if they had used those gauges, they could have really been in trouble. It would have been a dangerous canning situation.
So do then if that one is malfunctioning, is there a way to fix it, or do you just get a new gauge to put on?
You get a new one.
Okay.
Yeah. If it's 2 or 3 pounds, we help you work with the adjustments. If it's 3 or more, we highly recommend you get a new one. And then definitely 4 pounds, for sure, get a new one.
And with these large pressure canners, unlike the pressure cooker that usually has a rubber seal and maybe a little, I don't know what you call it, the thing that pops out if the pressure gets too high, you don't have that with the pressure canner. You have these knobs. There's 5. I can't remember it. 5 or 6 on the outside edge.
And
it's like a screw that you end up screwing them down. So you don't have to worry about replacing a rubber ring,
right,
or any rubber parts.
They're a little bit more expensive, but they are really nice. And to be honest with you, I have never really had any complaints about the cheaper canners. If you are using a Camp Chef, that Camp Chef can get really hot. And so just watch it really, really closely. You can't go off and mow the lawn while you're processing your food or whatever. In fact, Utah State University really recommends you don't use the Camp Chef for pressure canning. They really do.
Is it because we tend not to watch?
Yeah. If the wind comes up, that temperature is going to fluctuate. If that temperature fluctuates at all, technically you're supposed to start all over again with your canning time. So
all right,
be careful.
So here's... I'm the pressure canner pressure watcher.
Okay.
and we usually end up doing ours at night. So it has cooled down from the daytime temperatures, and it's just sitting there in the back. And the wind's not usually blowing because that makes it hard for the flame even to get there. But you're right. If you're not right there, that within just a minute or so, that can creep up a little more than you should. So
right.
If you're not right on top of it, don't do it.
Yeah, we were doing some canning with a high school a couple of weeks ago, and we were just doing the boiling water bath. But we were amazed at how quickly that temperature can go up on that Camp Chef. So just be really careful and watch it closely. Our food preservation specialist has actually a burner that has heated into a pan that he takes around to show for demonstrations.
So no.
Just watch it really, really closely if you insist on using your Camp Chef.
So what do you use if you have a smooth top stove?
Don't buy a smooth top stove if you're a canner. Just don't buy one. Supposedly, there are things that you can buy from some of the smooth top stove companies that are like burner types that you can, lift up your glass and put it in there and use it for canning. I have heard from, several consumers that that's what they've bought. But yeah, just don't buy one. Sorry.
Okay. Anything else that you want folks to know about using a pressure canner?
When you first start it up, make sure you read your directions about how much water you need to put into that pressure canner. Make sure some of them are 1 to 3 inches, some of them are 2 to 4, some of them are 3 quarts of water. Make sure you put the maximum amount, because I get calls, every fall, I ran out of water before my time was up. So put the maximum amount that your manufacturer recommends. The other thing is you've got to make sure you leave your petcock open or your little, there's a little doohickey that you put on top of that hole.
That you flip up that lets steam out.
Yeah. Leave that off for 10 minutes and let that boiling water.
What is the purpose for that? I was like, Robin, this is my wife. It says, why is that up? It says, it's taking longer. She says, well, that's what the instructions say to do.
You're letting the steam out so you get good concentrated heat. So anyway, they're letting the air out so that it's just concentrated steam basically, and it will be hotter. We've got... And then here again, I had a phone call where a lady had none of her bottles seal, and we found out she wasn't letting it steam for 10 minutes. So make sure you get that done.
Another good service by the extension office, you call in with your problems and they walk you through and find out what's going on.
Right. That's what we're here for.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You betcha.
You've been listening to Yes, You Can. It is our canning segment with Adri Roberts, Cache County's Extension Family and Consumer Sciences Agent. And we'll have her back in. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Hello. Welcome to this segment of The Zesty Garden. I'm the host, Brian Erland, but Mark Anderson is my guest. He's from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan, And we'd love to take your question or comments. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your question there. Or send us the old-fashioned way. Now, that's being old-fashioned.
Yes, old-fashioned.
Email is zestygarden@gmail.com. Mark, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Well, we were talking about some issues before coming on the air. One of those is voles.
Yeah.
And it seemed like I never had any voles in my garden. And then about 7 or so years ago, all of a sudden, humongous populations.
Yeah.
And then it dropped off for a couple of years, but I'm beginning to see some more issues again.
Coming back again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Voles, they're a little difficult to identify. And a lot of people think that they're mice, and they do kind of appear a lot like mice, but they've got a more rounded nose, a more grayish color, and a really short tail. So the first time my cat was catching them and bringing them in the house, I thought they were mice, and the cat had like chewed their tail off already. But no, they actually have a shorter tail, and they're much, much easier to catch, you know, because seriously, I've got a mouse or cat, and he's bringing 2, 3, 4 a day to the house. And if he brings a mouse inside, they're still alive, they run like crazy, and they're just quick and agile, and you can't keep your hands on them. And with the voles, they're much easier to track down. So they're a little slower and not as agile. So
I noticed our cat the other day through the living room window. He had one out on the front lawn and literally was throwing it in the air.
Oh,
was
yeah.
Going like 7 or 8 feet, and then he'd go pounce on it again.
Yeah. So they're having a good time. But the voles can do a lot of damage, not just in the lawns, you know, in turf, but also around your yard. They'll girdle the bark off of fruit trees. They'll damage shrubs. They'll eat your vegetables that are still out in the garden. I've had customers that have brought in, you know, full size mature beets that are just huge, you know, softball size. And they're hollow on the inside. And they're like, I've never seen anything like this before. It's like, well, you had vole visitors and they've, you know, eaten everything out of the inside. They just leave the exterior shell. It's really kind of interesting to
so
see.
So what's the best way to keep them out of your garden? I mean, that snow cover, once it comes, it's going to be just give them.
You know, there's a lot of natural predators out there. And then you've got cats that are catching them. And if you've got small
we
dogs.
We have some owls
behind
us.
So owls and hawks and snakes even. There's a lot of natural predators out there. But once the snow comes, they are pretty much hidden from all those natural predators unless they're up on the surface. So they hide down underneath the snow. They'll get between the snow and the soil, and they'll just make little, we call them vole utopias out there, out on the grass. And there's little trails going from one spot to the next, and they're nibbling on your grass, and they're eating, you know, whatever is out there, including your trees and other desirable plants, and just do a lot of damage. But there's some very safe and very effective repellents that work really well. They're made from castor oil. I don't think anybody likes castor oil from their childhood, but it's non-toxic, and it won't bother pets, and it won't bother, you know, other animals, won't bother people. You can use it as a granule or as a liquid and apply it to the perimeter of your yard in some strategic locations, maybe around the shed, around the barn, you know, anywhere where you think they might be, you know, trying to find a nice place to set up for winter. And if you've got a whole network, you know, where they've created a network of tunnels. You know, I've seen it under sidewalks, I've seen it under sheds, I've seen it in a lot of different locations. You'll see little holes. They look like gopher holes, but gophers push the soil up around the entrance, and so you get these little mounds that come up from the gophers. And the voles don't do that. There's just a hole in the ground, and their network of tunnels is underneath there. So you've got to probably bait in there to really get good control.
So is this just a repellent, or does it actually kill them?
The castor oil repels them, and so they'll just move and go somewhere else. So if you've got neighboring fields or, you know, a vacant lot next door, you know, it's open areas where, the voles are coming from, we can pretty much isolate them to those areas and keep them there instead of coming into your yard with the repellents. But if you notice a severe problem, and we've seen it for the last couple of months, so when we start seeing voles in August and September, we know the population is really high, and we've seen a ton of them this year. And I'd start doing a repellent right now. I'd start treating some of the to tunnel networks with some bait to try and get them under control before winter really sets in. There's some very nice baits you can use that are made with zinc phosphide. And as the zinc phosphide breaks down, it turns into zinc and phosphorus and, you know, fertilizes the plants. So it's not a problem with, you know, poisonous toxins building up in your soil. It really
But it's deadly to the...
Yeah. And it's only deadly to the first generation that eats it, too. So if you have a vole that eats it, and then your dog catches the vole and eats the vole, it's not going to bother your dog. So that's,
and that would be my concern with my cat. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and we have the same...
Or chickens. I mean, chickens will go after
the vole. We have the same concern, too. Some of the baits you got to watch out for a little bit, especially if you have chickens or birds, because they are oat and wheat-based. And so if you have them out there... could be attractive to them. And if they eat enough, it
I would
could
need
cause
to put them in a place where the chickens couldn't get to them, but the voles have no
exactly.
problem.
And so we'll make little bait stations with a PVC pipe, you know, 2-inch round PVC pipe. We'll cut it in 12-inch long sections. We'll put, you know, one over by the shed. We'll put one underneath the shrubs over here and one over by the deck and, you know, in strategic locations around your yard. And then put a couple scoops of the bait inside the bait station, and then neighboring pets won't bother it, and the chickens won't get into it, and it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. But the voles and other rodents as well, too. We're not just talking voles here, but it's going to get mice and it's going to get gophers and, you know, all kinds of...
Do we have gophers around here?
Yeah, we do have gophers. Oh. Not as bad as the voles, but we do see gophers as well, too. But they like to go inside those holes, and then all of a sudden there's like free lunch inside, and there's a exit on both ends if a predator comes after them. So they feel real comfortable inside there, and then there's a free snack, and they eat, away you go.
Now, these bait stations, can you purchase them, or can you just make them out of PVC pipe?
You can make them out of PVC pipe, and we make a bunch at the store, too, just for convenience. You know, if you don't want to have to go get your saw and go buy a big 8-foot-long piece of PVC pipe, we've got it cut up, and they're like $3 a piece, and they're pretty inexpensive.
And so you just put the bait in through the top?
Actually, 12 inches long, we'll just like take the scoop and just kind of put it right in the center of the tube, and then they can enter on either side and find the bait right there.
So okay. Works, I was thinking it was something like a T, and you put the food in the top.
You could do that too, you know, but this way it's definitely protected from the elements inside the bait stations. And you can also put the bait down in the holes. And so usually what we'll do is we'll recommend you put the bait down in the holes and then cover the holes up with something so they don't just come right back out. So put a brick or a rock or something over the top of it. If you fill it up with dirt, a lot of times the dirt will cover your bait up as well, too, unless you can get the bait down deeper into the tunnel and then cover it up. And then I've got some brand new smokers that will smoke them out of their tunnel networks, and they're made with the castor oil also. So it's just got a little fuse on it. You light it. You put it upside down into the hole. It kind of plugs the hole up. And the cool thing about it is you can figure out where all the holes are. Because once the smoker starts going, it smokes the whole tunnel network, and then you see little puffs of smoke coming up out of the holes. And so you can go find the holes a lot easier as well, too. But they absolutely hate the smell of the castor oil, so they'll just leave and go somewhere else.
I'm especially laughing because our building, our sewer lines plugged somewhere, and so Roto-Rooter was in there this morning.
Yeah.
And wherever there's a drain in the floor, the smell's coming up. So it's just kind of the same thing. We're all leaving the building.
The smokers work really well. They are not available for sale yet. So they're brand new. They're being approved by the EPA right now. They'll be ready for spring. But I have some free samples. So if someone would like to try it, I've got 10 free samples. All I ask is in return for the free sample, you bring me some feedback and let me know how well they work. Yeah. So
what types of plants do the voles and the mice go after in particular? Are there some perennials or fruit trees that they like better than others?
Definitely all the fruit trees. So the bark must just be delicious to them on some of the fruit trees. So they always go after the fruit trees. They definitely are bothering turf and a lot of root crops as well, too. But not necessarily any ornamental perennials that I can think of that are more delicious to them.
They might nibble here or there.
Yeah, they might really go after that I can think of. So
okay.
Yeah.
Well, so while we're talking about perennials, can we still move them? Is it okay to divide a perennial and move it somewhere else?
It's perfect timing. So even though we're towards the end of October, we still have at least 2, 3, 4 weeks maybe before the soil really starts to freeze up. I mean, we'll get some frozen soil here and there in November, but it's really not until December the soil really kind of freezes solid up for the wintertime. And if you can get those plants transplanted and start to get established before that soil temperature really starts to drop, they have plenty of time to get reestablished and ready to go for next spring, and a great time to go ahead and do that. I'd probably recommend you do it before the 1st of November, though.
And then just, yeah. And once you've found a place and prepared the soil and put it in, does it need any extra fertilizer or just put it in and water it in really well?
You know, the last couple of years we've been experimenting with a couple new rooting solutions, and we've always liked Fernilome's root stimulator. That's been great. We've used that for a long time. We've used a lot of mycorrhiza. The natural mycorrhiza are great for transplanting plants. It helps reestablish the root system faster, and the beneficial microbes in the mycorrhiza live with the plant for the rest of its life and help, you know, bring nutrient water to it. But I've got a new one that's called Kangaroots that is from Fox Farm. And it's got the beneficial microbes and the mycorrhiza and a mild rooting hormone and a natural fertilizer in there. This is an all organic product, and it has been amazing. It's incredible.
And they just tend to help get them established?
Yeah, quicker? and it's just water soluble. You mix it up in water. After you get your plants transplanted to their new location, water them with the Kangaroots for the first 2 or 3 waterings, and it provides them with the beneficial, you know, mycorrhiza and microbes and the nutrient that it needs to reestablish itself and get that root system going again. And I've actually never seen plants root as fast as I have done with the Kangaroots this year. Mm. I mean, just honestly amazing.
And are there any perennials that don't like to be transplanted?
Mm. They all pretty much need to be transplanted at some point. Once they start getting too large, I mean, you plant a 1 gallon perennial and it's, you know, 6 inches across, and in 4 years it's 2 feet across, yeah. and they just get big and overgrown and are kind of fighting for the same nutrient, water and space and light, and it's just a good idea to transplant those and divide them and spread them out and give them a little bit of their own space to grow in. Otherwise they'll just kind of stagnate and stop growing.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. Mark Anderson is my guest. If you'd like to call in with your question or comment, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can go online and send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or go to our Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So, Mark, you've got your phone out. Are you sending yourself a question?
I'm sending myself a question, yes.
Okay. So
I'm texting myself a question. So there we go.
One of the things that I wanted to look at, and we were talking again about this before the program, is preparing for next year and having things that will attract pollinators in your garden.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Now I put in some natives, not yeah. to track pollinators, just because, oh, these look really cool, yeah. and I got them on sale and I didn't know where I was going to put them, so sure. I put them in the garden.
Yeah.
Well, now I need to move one of them because it's gotten gigantic in just 1 year.
Yeah.
But I noticed that because of the bees that were there, I had a little bit better production in my squash that happens to be around that area.
Yeah.
So so let's talk about.
Have you got a hive?
I don't, because I know darn well I wouldn't take care of it the way that it needs to be taken care of.
I inherited a hive. My brother's done hives down in Pleasant Grove for quite a few years, and then my dad's got a big property and a lot of fruit trees and a huge garden, and so he thought this would be a perfect place to, you know, to put a hive. And the last 2 years he's had some health issues that have kind of prohibited him from coming up and tending that hive as much as he'd like, and so I kind of inherited it. Not accidentally, but just out of necessity, and it's really kind of fun. It's a little bit challenging, and it's a learning process where I'm learning new things all the time. And I got to extract honey for the first time this year, and I don't know if I care much for that.
kind of a sticky process.
It's honestly, it's kind of a mess. Yeah, it's a giant mess, and the fruits of your labor are wonderful. I mean, the honey is amazing, but I am not sure if I prefer to let someone else do that for me or if I want to do it
now,
again.
Did you see your fruit production or your vegetable production go up?
Since we put the hive in, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So it's been a great addition to our garden, and I really enjoy tending the hive, and I have a good relationship with the bees. They must understand my profession because they don't give me trouble. They know that I have things that would be detrimental to their health.
Spin this off into a business. Anderson's less troubling bee.
No, but I have a good relationship with my hive. They get it, and they don't bother me too much, and I try not to bother them. I figure they lived for thousands of years without me tending them every week. That I think they can handle themselves. So I'm kind of a minimalist, and it's really not too much work. But I really wanted to provide them with some extra pollen this year, and so I experimented with some of the most common flowers that that the bees really like the pollen, and so I did a little bit of research. I found, you know, it's the top 20 flowers that the bees really like for annuals, because I wanted to plant annuals in my garden because it does bring the pollinators in, and they bloom and bloom and bloom and bloom all summer, where the perennials, it seems like the bees really, really like the perennials, but they only bloom for a couple weeks and then they're done. So I did a whole bunch of annuals in my garden just to see what happened. So we did sunflowers, did California poppies, bachelor buttons, asters, Gaudetia, and bachelor buttons. Did I say bachelor buttons? I can't remember. I think I did one other one. And hands down, they were all over the bachelor buttons.
So if you had 100 bees?
Yeah.
In a particular area?
This is what I told you. If I had 100 bees in one spot, 90 of them were on the bachelor buttons, and they just bloomed and bloomed and bloomed all summer. And every time I went out there, they were literally covered with bees. Bees were just all over the bachelor buttons.
Do the bachelor buttons reseed?
We'll find out. But I'm going to till it up. I mean, I till that garden pretty vigorously in the fall. We add a lot of organic matter and some nutrients, some humate, and we'll really build that soil back up. It's kind of heavy clay. It's my neighbor's garden, and so we've been working on it the last couple of years trying to break that clay up and condition that soil. So we'll add a lot of organic matter this fall, add some zeolite, some humate, and a little bit of fertilizer to help break that down, and I'll till that in real heavy, and I'll be surprised if any flowers come back next year. But I will definitely be planting the sunflowers and the bachelor buttons again, with the asters and the California poppies. Oh, calendula. That's the other one that I planted, was calendula. And the calendula and the Gaudetia, I had to fight the deer. And the deer
just kept chomping.
Yeah, so it might not have been a fair test to which flowers the bees preferred the most, because the deer were competing with the bees on who's going to eat the flowers first.
Now, we do have a caller on the line from Green River, but I just wanted to ask real quick. So do you have a tall fence around your garden to keep the deer out?
I wish.
So how do you keep them out of your garden?
You don't. There's some repellents that do work pretty well, but when it comes down to it, I just don't have the time to stay on top of it, and I should be a little bit more diligent.
So you plant a lot of root crops.
Yeah. My dad's got a fence, and he uses a 7-foot fence around certain areas of his garden. That's the problem. When your garden's 6,000 square feet, it's tough to put up a fence all the way around. Yeah, so we kind of, I net things. I'll throw nets over, like our squashes and a little bit of chicken wire, and we've had some pretty good success with the areas that I protected with the netting and the chicken wire, for sure. So,
well, we'd love to have your question or comment. It's 1-800-826-1495. Email is zestygarden@gmail.com, or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your question or comment. And we'll now go to Green River, Utah, with Stu. Hi, Stu. How can we help?
Am I too late to ask a question about the perennials?
Not at all. Go ahead.
Okay, several years ago, I divided a peony bush. It wasn't blooming, and I thought it might benefit from more sun. Well, since I've done that, the divisions, they'll come back, but none of them look really healthy. Is there any comment about peony bushes?
Yeah, and when you're transplanting the peonies, there's a couple things you really have to watch out for, or it can kind of stunt their growth and prevent them from really thriving and doing well. timing is kind of critical. It's best to do the peonies well after they're done blooming. We'll usually do them about the same time that Brian likes to do his iris. You know, July, August is a good time to transplant those and move those around. Or
so they're almost a little bit dormant.
Fall's a good time to do it still too, but you really want to wait till after that bloom period's over and they're kind of starting to die down just a little bit. And then as you prepare them to go back in the garden, full sun definitely. So your intentions were right on. They really want a full sun location, well-drained soil. They don't like a heavy clay soil. So if you've got a lot of clay or alkaline soil, you've got to amend that soil with some organic matter and try and get that soil loosened up and light and fluffy so that the peonies will do better. We'll usually put a slow-release fertilizer in with them when we plant, like a bone meal, because it breaks down so gradually over a couple of years. That's a great way to really help get some root development going back on those peonies. And then make sure the crowns are exactly 2 inches below the surface. I mean, as close to 2 inches as you can get. Because if they're too deep or they're too shallow, they don't bloom well. They just stop.
My problem's probably the heavy clay alkaline soil.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
And those are common problems for anywhere in Cache Valley and along the Intermountain West. I mean, just all our soils is kind of heavy clay and alkaline. So if you can use a good soil conditioner, try and avoid steer manure. Don't use anything that's got composted steer in it, but more of a composted poultry bark combo. My favorite's called soil building compost. It's a finely ground redwood bark with poultry manure and bat guano and worm castings and kelp meal. It's great for breaking up clay soils. And zeolite is amazing. If you've never used the zeolite, that's what they used in the soil mix on top of the conference center down in Salt Lake. And it's kind of volcanic rock, but it's great for breaking up clay. It doesn't biodegrade and break down over time. I mean, it stays there pretty much indefinitely and keeps that soil from clumping back up. So that would be a great option for you as well, too.
What is the name again?
It's called zeolite, and it's spelled Zeolite. And there's a couple brand names of it. So Utilite, you know, Utilite is the one that we carry, but it comes out of the Bear River Valley. I mean, it comes just out of, you know, Preston area up here, and it's a volcanic rock. It's very porous, and it actually, for being a rock, it actually holds moisture, but it's great for breaking up soil. It looks kind of like cat litter.
Okay.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Thank you very much.
You're
great.
Very welcome.
Thanks for your call, Stu.
Okay.
Again, take care. Again, it's 1-800-826-1495. 800-826-1495. Utah Public Radio Facebook page. You can post your question or comment there. We've only got about 8 minutes left with Mark.
Or that's all?
Yeah, about 8 minutes. Man. Or zestygarden@gmail.com. And it looks like we've got someone else on the line. We'll bring them here in just a minute. So let's talk about the zeolite. So.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, is it just tiny little pieces?
Yeah, like I said, it looks like cat litter. I mean, if you were to buy a bag of cat litter and open it up and buy a bag of zeolite and compare it, they look very similar in size and structure.
I'm thinking if you put sand in clay, you get cement.
You get concrete.
How come this doesn't
create? It's a larger piece, and sand has no absorptive properties to it,
right.
So it won't hold moisture. The zeolite, if you put it under a microscope, it looks like you went up to Idaho Falls and went through the lava fields there, and you're
okay.
Picking up lava rock. I mean, it looks
so porous.
It looks like lava rock. It has just tons and tons of little holes in it, and those little holes create surface tension. And so when the water hits it, it pulls the water into all those little teeny tiny holes and holds it there until the soil surrounding the zeolite dries out. And once it dries out through reverse osmosis, it sucks it right back out of the zeolite.
Okay.
And so even though it looks like rock, and it is basically rock, it has great water absorbing and retention qualities to it. And so we've used it in our raised beds. We've used it to break up clay soils. I'm putting it on my garden this fall to help condition
it. How much are you putting on the garden?
Oh, 30-pound bag. The bags are 1 cubic foot, and they end up running about 30 pounds. They're around 30 pounds. It's not very expensive. It's like $6 for a bag, so it's not bad. But really, you should only cover about 100 square feet with a bag, maybe even less, to really get the full results out of it. And so the zeolite's pretty inexpensive. You want to put on fairly heavy. You want to incorporate it into the soil. It works better incorporated in instead of sitting on the surface, because it's going to draw moisture out of the soil if it's sitting on the surface. So you want to incorporate it into the soil. And unlike, say, a bark or a organic matter amendment that's going to degrade over time, it's going to break down, it's going to disappear, basically, it's going to turn back into the soil, this will stay out there indefinitely.
Okay.
Since it's rock.
And that's why you're saying it works better than the sand, because the sand, you mix it in and it just fills up all of those pores and makes it even less likely to let the water drain through. Where this
zeolite will actually, it'll improve drainage and help water retention and break up that clay. So
our next caller is Jeff from Logan. Hi, Jeff. How can we help?
Hello. My question is about a product or a byproduct called biochar.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could tell me what it does, how it's made or where, and then how that is to be used around the house or around the garden, I suppose.
That's a really good question, and I am familiar with the biochar, but I don't have a lot of information on it. I've gathered some information for another customer on it, and it is available. I think we were having to get it out of Idaho, but it's supposed to be really, really high in micronutrients. And so it's used as a supplement in your soil to build the soil back up after you've been using it for a while and you think it's depleted. And so I've never used the biochar, so I can't give you any personal firsthand experience on it, and I've actually never sold it before either, but I've heard a lot of good things about it.
Well, if you want to believe Wikipedia, it's a name for charcoal when it's used for particular purposes, especially as a soil amendment.
There you go.
So,
okay.
Kind of help.
So is it a wood byproduct then?
According to this picture, it looks like it's a wood byproduct.
Yeah.
It's created through the pyrolysis process, whatever that is.
Yeah.
Like, again, this is just Wikipedia, so I don't know how accurate it is.
They're saying if it acts like charcoal, it's going to filter a lot of impurities out of the soil as well too. And we've had really good luck doing that with compost tea as well too. If you build your natural soil microbes up, they'll actually break a lot of that stuff down and consume diseases and pathogens that are out there in your soil.
It does say it can increase soil fertility, agricultural productivity, and provides protection against some foliar and soil-borne diseases.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, very well. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye-bye. And now we're down to about 3.5 minutes left, 1-800-826-1495 or zestygarden@gmail.com. And we have Margaret in Vernal. Hi, Margaret. Welcome back to the program.
You were going to talk about winterizing roses.
Yes,
I wondered if you'd just go through that, please.
Absolutely. We're coming up on the best time to winterize your roses. I prefer not to prune at all in the fall. If possible, let your roses form rose hips. Let those blossoms just fade right on the plants. Let them form rose hips. It'll actually help them become prepared for winter better. It'll get them ready for winter time if you leave those hips on there. Don't prune them. If you do have to prune them this fall, do it as late as you possibly can, like even into December. And probably in the next 2 or 3 weeks, as we're gathering leaves up that are really starting to fall off the trees now, I'll pick that up with the lawnmower and get a little bit of grass clippings in there with it. And you can use that to mulch your roses with, but then you have to clean it up in the spring. So the last couple of years I've been using the soil building compost or a soil prep or peat moss or something that I can actually incorporate into the soil in the springtime to mulch those roses with. But what I'll do is I'll do a quarter of a cup of magnesium sulfate and a quarter of a cup of potash on each one of my roses, and I'll sprinkle it on the ground around the roses, water it thoroughly, and then 12 to 16 inches of a mulch or compost in around those grafts of the roses, and then a lot of snow on top of it. Keep your fingers crossed for a lot of snow this year. And it really helps the roses winter a lot better if we get 2 feet of snow on top of mulch. And a lot of times I'll take the snowblower and go down the driveway and I'll throw that snow on top of the roses if Mother Nature's not taking care of it, somebody has to. So, but that works great. The mag sulfate and the potash will actually make your roses is about 10 degrees hardier through the wintertime than they would be otherwise. And then the mulch will help insulate them and prevent the cold from penetrating in and leaving really quickly. And that's what does a lot of the damage. It's not the cold itself. It's the quick, drastic changes in temperature that really does a lot of damage to the roses. And that's what that prevents.
Roses on their own roots.
It's a good idea to protect those as well, but they tend to be a little hardier in the first place also. And if they die back to the soil line, they'll come back true to form, where a grafted rose, if it dies down past the graft, you're done.
Yeah,
so.
Very good. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Margaret.
Good luck with your roses, Margaret.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. So 1/4 cup magnesium sulfate,
yep.
And 1/4 cup of potash. And you just mix those together, sprinkle it around the base and water.
Don't even have to mix them together. Just sprinkle one and then sprinkle the other on. Water it well. Same thing goes for bulbs. If you're planting bulbs right now, make sure you get them watered because we haven't had a good storm for a couple weeks now.
September was great.
First part of October was really wet too, but then the last two and a half weeks, it's been really dry. So if you're planting bulbs, you're transplanting your perennials, you're doing any of this stuff, make sure you water your plants because if that soil gets dry and then it freezes and then we don't get a lot of snow that melts on top of it, you're dry all winter long. And I know on the news they say, shut your sprinklers off and do this. And it's like, yeah, you got to do that. But if we don't get moisture from Mother Nature and the soil's dry in the fall, you will be dry all winter and your plants will suffer the next year because of it.
All right. Great. Thanks, Mark.
You're very welcome.
You've been listening to Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Williams, and I'm here today to read you a little bit about Halloween, which, as we know, is right around the corner. And if we're parents, we know we need to celebrate, and some of us just stay kids and love it our entire lives. So this is a little bit about Halloween from my favorite cookbook essay writer, Lori Colwin. And this is a collection of columns pretty much that she wrote when she was editor for Gourmet magazine. And this is just talking about Halloween and what kind of goodies we can make from our garden goodies. As every parent knows, children are great traditionalists. All you need to do is set something in motion and you will find yourself doing it the same way year after year after year. Psychologists say this is good for us. The things that keep mankind going, ritual, stability, routine, are beginning to fray, and we are all the worse for it. No matter what else happens in October, Halloween is still the big deal. Therefore, if I forget to buy that nasty synthetic woolly stuff that one tacks to windows to look like fake cobwebs, chaos reigns. My daughter likes the same thing year after year after year, and I must confess that I do too. On Halloween, the parents in our neighborhood dress up their precious angels and form a parade, complete with flashlights and homemade noisemakers, and march around the General Theological Seminary. Afterward, people must be taken home and fed, usually the same thing that you fed them last year. I don't mind admitting that I have never liked pumpkin. I hate pumpkin pie and am lukewarm about pumpkin soup. I once had an unhappy encounter with a stew served in a pumpkin. It did not further endear pumpkin to me. I've bought cheese pumpkins as well as pie or sweetie pie pumpkins. These are pale orange, dense fleshed, not a bit stringy, and not to be used for jack-o'-lanterns. I have steamed them and baked them and fried them. I have dotted them with butter and brown sugar and scattered them with garlic and cheese. And I still say it's pumpkin and the hell with it. Children, however, seem to require something pumpkin-like on the table at Halloween, even if they don't eat it. For them, I recommend butternut or acorn squash, split, seeded, and baked with butter and brown sugar. The seeds, of course, go into a colander with the seeds from the jack-o'-lantern to be endlessly washed and separated from any pumpkin or squash sludge, and then drained, salted, and roasted. When you serve these before or after dinner, even adults will tell you how delicious they are. For grown-ups, I suggest the pumpkin tian in John Thorne's noble and mighty book, Simple Cooking. John Thorne, who lives in Maine, puts out a newsletter of the same name, which is enchanting, opinionated, and full of good things. The pumpkin tien, in addition to being one of the most delicious things you will ever eat, demonstrates that the whole is more magnificent than the sum of its meager parts. The first time I made this dish, I almost collapsed at the realization that something so easy could taste so wonderful. My version of the recipe calls for either butternut or delicata squash, or a combination of the two. For squash tien, proportions aren't the issue, method is. But for four people, you probably need two big butternuts or four of the sweeter, medium-sized delicatas. Peel, seed, and cut the butternut squash into 1-inch chunks. For the delicata, you just cut it in half lengthwise, take out the seeds, and cut its little scalloped self into 1-inch half circles. Don't bother peeling it. Shake the chunks in a bag of flour, shaking off the excess flour, and put them in an oiled or buttered shallow baking dish. Scatter the squash with about 1/3 cup of good Parmesan cheese, 1 large minced clove of garlic, and pepper to taste. Drizzle the tien with about 1/3 cup of olive oil, your very best kind, and put it into a preheated 400-degree oven. The oven must be really hot, or instead of a crispy-topped, melting dish, you will end up with a sodden mess. Trust me, I've had this happen. Bake the tien for 30 to 40 minutes. I myself would be very happy to eat this with a salad, but as we do not necessarily live by vegetables alone, something else must be provided, especially if you provided it last year. I recommend meatloaf, which is good hot, cold, or at room temperature and can be made in advance. It is nice, homey food and usually a hit with old and young. I love meatloaf of any kind. Like potato salad, it always seems to be good. I've never run into an unlovable meatloaf, but I have loved some better than others. A few years ago, I ran into a really delicious meatloaf at Cadwell's Corner, the premier breakfast and lunch place in West Cornwall, Connecticut. This meatloaf's winning feature is its texture, which is light and velvety. Naturally, I attempted to prize out of David Cadwell, an agreeable bearded former coffee buyer and father of twins, the secret of his success, which actually may be that of his wife Alice. The trick, he said, is to soak 2 1-inch thick slices of homemade bread, you've trimmed the crusts off of these, in 1 cup of buttermilk for 20 minutes. And then you stir that mixture into 2 pounds of ground chuck and with 2 large eggs. The Cadwells make their own bread, but any good grainy loaf will do. Perfectionists can buy a round loaf, about 7 inches in diameter and 3 inches high, and cut 2 slices right from the middle. In a pinch, you can use 2 slices of the best packaged bread you can find. It doesn't matter how you season the meatloaf. Every cook has a different method. I use 1 large garlic clove, minced, 1 tablespoon of Dijon-style mustard, 1 teaspoon of Worcestershire sauce, and 1 tablespoon of ketchup. Sometimes I add 2 tablespoons of a nice thing called ortolina, which tastes rather like a concentrated form of V8 vegetable juice. You can buy it in a tube or a jar in specialty shops. Bake the meatloaf in a loaf pan, 9 by 5 by 3 inches, at 350 degrees for about 1 hour. The bread and the buttermilk combination makes this meatloaf light and springy. If you keep kosher, rich chicken stock will probably work as well as buttermilk. After a green salad, the children will want dessert. Of course, you have stayed up the night before decorating a spiderweb cake. I made this 1 year and have not been permitted to stop. It is any old cake decorated with orange icing, using the fine nib of the cake decorating kit, the one that you write happy birthday with, in a spiderweb design. And because you have been a good person and have bought that nasty synthetic woolly stuff that makes the fake cobwebs, you will also have a black plastic spider, which comes in that package, to put on your cake. That is, unless you are amazingly energetic and have decided to create your own spider out of icing, which can be done by anyone that possesses paste food coloring and a field guide. But what kind of cake? My vote is for something called Wensley cake, a recipe from a now-defunct cooking magazine. it is a sad fact that in my whole life that many of my best recipes come from now defunct sources. You know, mine too. A Wensley cake is meant to have a layer of Wensleydale cheese. I have made it this way, and although I thought it was delicious, my family found it weird. Made without cheese, it is just plain delicious. Here's the recipe for Wensley cake. 1. Beat together 2 sticks of butter and 1 cup of brown sugar. 2. Beat in 4 lightly beaten large eggs. 3. Stir in 2 cups of all-purpose flour, 1 teaspoon baking powder, 1 teaspoon ground ginger, and 1/4 teaspoon each of mace, ground cloves, and cinnamon. 4. Stir in 1 cup golden raisins. Dried cherries are a very nice substitute if you're lucky enough to have some. Also, 1 1/4 cups of currants, 1 cup of dark raisins, 1 cup of grated apple, and the grated zest of 1 orange. Mix all of that well. Bake the cake in a buttered 8-inch round cake pan that's 2 inches deep, lined with parchment paper in the middle of a preheated 375-degree oven for 25 minutes. Reduce the heat to 325 and bake for 1 hour more, checking the cake from time to time. It is done when a skewer comes out with some crumbs adhering to it. The cake, wrapped in wax paper and stored in a tin, improves after a few days and keeps well if you happen to have any left. This nice old-fashioned dessert has a lot of depth to it. In fact, the whole Halloween meal has a lot of depth to it. A cheering supper on a spooky night, usually right after daylight savings time disappears and the sky gets dark at about 4:30. Last year, our children marched happily around the block, and the minute they got inside, a torrential storm broke. A 10-year-old neighbor appeared wearing a gorilla suit and a terrifying mask with little red eyes that blinked. And although he kept taking off his mask and saying, "Don't be scared, I'm Robert Jordan," my daughter and her friends remained in a state of exhausted petrifaction. Then my husband appeared, having been pelted with eggs and almost mugged by some overzealous teens. The rain beat down, Robert's mask was taken off for good, my husband's jacket was put in the washing machine, and after dinner, not a crumb was left. I'll put this recipe up on UPR's website, upr.org, under the Zesty Garden tab, if any of you would like to do that. I'm going to try it this year, I'll tell you that. Thanks for being with me, and have a happy Halloween, all of you. See you next time. This is Nancy Williams.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producers Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.